Yes.
You just got northern.
Oh, damn.
All right. So the term northerned is, I actually tried looking it up in like online dictionaries and it doesn't exist.
I don't think it's a word. I think we made it up.
No, it's not. Yeah. The Beaches Deer Band made it up. Getting northerned came up when we'd be at festivals in the north. And our flight would get canceled or delayed, or we wouldn't have our tickets at the airport counter. And I think it was Chris that said, we're northerned. Or we're at a festival and we were given a set time and we're just hanging out at our house, killing time. And then someone would like run into our house and say, you're on next. You're on stage next. So let's go. Northerned. Mm-hmm. anything like anything related to the north. Like you didn't
like
expect.
Running out of water.
Northerned. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because we get delivered water in Nunavik. There, we don't have underground water pipes because of permafrost. So we get our water
and sewage
picked up. So when we run out of that, northerned.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Internet cuts out, northerned. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
You get your heel stuck inside the railings, like
the
in the door that are made for ice and snow. You're northerned.
Yeah.
So, I like how you say it too.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the name of our show because we're Tanya and I are Inuit women and we talk about our life experience as Inuit women. And we love having different guests on this show, Inuit or not. So we have Laurel and now we have Jess Robertson. And she is, I'm meeting you for the first time, so I'm going to read your bio. Jess Robertson is the Motto Yoga co-founder. In addition to thousands of hours in yoga study, Jess's academic studies focus on the history and anthropology of medicine. Wow. With post-grad study in Buddhism. Jess spent 6 years in the nonprofit sector for both Amnesty International and EarthSave. Wow.
Goosebumps.
That's impressive, Jess. Nice to meet you.
So
thanks
nice
for being
to
with
meet
us
you.
Today.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having
yeah,
me.
Yeah. I would love to talk about all your studies and your findings and it's very cool. Yes. And you know Laurel.
Yeah, we go way back and it was a surprise for me today for both Jess and I that we would both be on this show. So
we actually had dinner plans tonight.
Yeah. But dinner plans after like weeks of us trying to get together. Like
really?
It's been a long time since we've been able to spend time. We've been trying for a bit and yeah, so
that's what it's like down here.
It is.
It really is like that down here. Like
yeah.
Whereas in the north we just show up at mm-hmm. people's house. Like it's so small in
and
the
life
community.
Isn't as busy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We also bump into each other a lot more often.
Yeah, because there's one store, mm-hmm.
one
gas
post
station,
office.
One post office, mm-hmm. one school.
Like one street.
One clinic.
That's so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very different. So Jess, what kind of medicine, the history of anthropology of medicine, can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So I kind of always thought as a kid that I would be a doctor, you mm-hmm. know, like in allopathic medicine. And as I grew up with a hidden disability, which is a very advanced scoliosis curvature in my spine. So I wore a plastic body brace that went from my hips to my shoulders and it was kind of like a real thing identity-wise and also learning about what it meant to be healthy and how other other people looked at your health. You know, in Toronto, the main hospital for children is called Sick Kids.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you're generally labeled as a sick kid if you go there regularly, which I did for sure for my whole childhood. And then I kind of started to feel that the alternative approaches to healing and well-being were much more aligned with my own experience of getting better, getting out of chronic pain. And so studying cross-culturally how we viewed the body and how throughout different cultures, and that's the anthropology part, we have looked at the body as a vehicle for learning, which is how I think I would view healing. That became really my core interest in life.
Wow.
And continues to be.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. That's, mentioning anthropology and like different types of medicine in different cultures. Did you happen to like hear about Inuit traditional medicines?
Inuit specifically, I would have to say that I don't know, because a lot of times, and I don't know if you experience this, but there's like this grouping, you know, like Indigenous.
Yeah.
And and I
the umbrella.
There's an umbrella, and I think that as a Jewish woman, I think that happens with Judaism too, where it's like, oh, you're Jewish, that means this. Uh-huh. Whereas there's a lot of nuance and intricacy.
Yeah.
And I definitely was raised with a lot of ideas from Indigenous teachers and authors mostly, and have read a lot from like Jamie Sams. Like I actually brought my favorite book, which as you can see, I actually travel with it, even though I can also like always pull it up. But the medicine cards is like, for me, really like if I ever dream of something, I think the subconscious has a huge part to play in health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to look up deer before I got here. But I know, you know, like gentleness and just before I met you, you know. But right. But I think the concept of, I guess, ask you if the concept of circle is as important. Restorative justice is a huge inspiration for me that comes.
Yeah.
That I think is in the Inuit tradition, but I would have to ask you to confirm.
Yeah. We very much believe in how we say karma, but we don't actually use that word in Inuktitut. Mm-hmm. But we do believe in like how you treat people, it will come back to you.
And treat animals.
Yeah, and treat animals. It'll come back to you. If you're cruel to even insects, be careful, because that can come back to you. Teachings like if you're pregnant, don't mock crippled people, or your child will be born crippled.
Mm.
Things like that. So yes, we do believe in like full circle. Be kind and kindness will come back to you. Give and you will be given. So our
respect nature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like share food. In our culture, food doesn't have an owner. So if you share your harvest, like a seal or caribou or whatever, it'll come back in abundance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our belief in, like, it's that circle.
Mm. And is there a sense of going to nature for healing?
Yeah, very much. Being out in nature is very soothing and calming. It's like there isn't a place that's quite like it, where you really feel you're at the mercy of nature and you respect it even more. Weather can change drastically in a matter of minutes. So, like, it's important to learn the environment, your surroundings, pay attention, be present, and know what your you have in your environment, because you never know when you're going to need whatever it is at your hands.
And back then, there was no other choice. You were on the land. You were in nature. So people were healthier, you know. And then it came along the white man. I keep saying.
You people.
And, you know, I think now people are, they reach for nature for healing. Mm-hmm. But back then, people were already healthier because it was, they were just always out
and eating like organic food all the time.
Mm-hmm. And like now we see, because we're decolonizing, we're more educated, we're realizing that the white man wasn't necessarily right about everything. So we see, like, for instance, there's a treatment center being built, or that would be the white word for it, but it's like a, you know, they're taking people out on the land that need a retreat for their mental health, and then doing these activities that are
cultural
people.
Activities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
and
so,
disconnecting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's called Histoire Civic Recovery Center. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think they even included Family Recovery Center. Mm-hmm. I think.
And there's a huge aspect of spending that time out on the land.
Yeah, that's the new program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this only recovery center in Nunavik for the population of 14,000, it's the only recovery rehab center, which is insane because we need it so much. Another topic. Mm-hmm. So for you, you've been there, hey Tan?
Yep.
Yeah.
I graduated from Histoire Civic Treatment Center 15 and a half years ago.
Yeah.
Saved my life.
Strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so proud of you. Uh-huh. For the first time, this recovery center is including on the land as part of their recovery program. And it's a program that's created by Inuit for Inuit. Because forever, you're trying to, like, if you're going to create something that works, it has to be by the people who, like, from that culture. Mm-hmm. Because it can't work if it's created by someone else from a different world. I'm very happy and I'm very supportive of Histoire Civic.
So excited. Excited about Histoire Civic. Used to be a different building. I don't know what building, but anyway, they've just opened a beautiful big new treatment center with many different programs, and it's more focused on family and Inuit traditions and nurturing the inner artists that we are as a people.
Identity.
Yeah.
Like really focusing on identity.
It's brand spanking new, so we're super excited about it.
Because I find that sobriety and like addiction issues are related to the self, the authentic self, and knowing that authentic self is where we get our grounding. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to talk with you more about that because of your extensive studies in yoga and Buddhism. So let the gates open.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I'm so interested in asking you questions from and learning from you. And I also am here to be interviewed. So so I'm cognizant of that. And yeah, I mean, I think in a Buddhist and yoga approach to addiction specifically, it's totally aligned with what you're talking about in finding the right and claiming the right to be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for various reasons that are absolutely myriad and numerous, mm-hmm. limitless, perhaps, we are pulled away from who we are. And I think that a lot of the wisdom practices, whether that wherever that wisdom practice sources from, we're being brought back to an ability to listen closely to our inner voice. And I think that when you were talking about the North, what I pictured was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I really quiet. Forgot about winter when I arrived here after being living in Central America for nearly eight years, was being back in the, and how sound is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And we are often trying to cultivate environments where we can even have that kind of quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I that must be so impactful to be brought out onto the land where that is the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Like, in this day and age, we are always bombarded like with responsibilities, with circumstances happening around us, things we don't have control over. And being Inuit and Indigenous people, we have so much generational trauma and like anxiety issues and all sorts of stuff. But when we go on the land, we are very present.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're not, there are no phones, there are no internet. It's just you and the air, the land, what you see, and the thrill of looking for what you're hunting, the joy of fishing, and really connecting to people around you in a different way where, like, a day-to-day setting
could never imitate.
Yeah, but being on the land, it's mm-hmm. like another level of communicating.
And being quiet is mm-hmm. definitely huge in our culture. Like, I just think about the differences in, say, maybe sharing a meal in the South with Southern friends. It's loud. People are talking. It's fun. People are making jokes. But back home, when people eat together, it's often very quiet.
It's silent.
It's silent. You can
you hear chewing.
Yeah, that's it. You know, but it goes back to many different things. One being, like, back then you were eating sometimes in the cold. You didn't have time to chit chat, or you didn't have the desire to. So it was all about you and surviving and connecting with this meal that's going to keep you alive and being quiet with that. And so being quiet is really big in our culture. And
yeah.
And it's a teaching in and of itself.
Even yeah. when we're mourning. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a, I mean, that is something that we could learn mm-hmm. by, we Southerners mm-hmm. could learn just by going north mm-hmm. and yeah. Having the experience, because that is so distinct what mm-hmm. you're talking about, the experience of being quiet around a meal. And mm-hmm. and that's, to me, when just from an outside perspective, listening to you speak about that, it speaks to the quiet as a teacher mm-hmm. that you've all had growing up, that's so mm-hmm. that's bears so much wisdom that you innately have, that is so incredible that you're sharing in this way and in others.
You learn while you're quiet. Even when we're mourning, we all gather when we're mourning, but we're silent. You're just there.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to say much. Mm-hmm. And when there's a loss, if someone passes away,
in the community,
whoever, like everybody kind of gathers at that house, mm-hmm. at that home. Even
it's just
children.
What you do. Yeah. It's yeah, just what you do. Mm-hmm. Even if, it's a 90-year-old woman and I'm 17, it's just what you do. And yeah. you go in and it's silent, but you're there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
actually they sometimes or often do puzzles. Silent.
Yeah. Yeah. Puzzles mm-hmm. or Chinese checkers.
Mm-hmm. Very silent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And bring food.
Bring food, mm-hmm. have tea, mm-hmm. bring yoga, bannock. And
be in people, the moment together.
Yeah. And when they're like sick people are in their last days, people, relatives, family will stay up all night with the family, with the wife, with mm-hmm. the husband, just to be there for support. And down here, they don't do that.
Another
like Inuit do.
Thing too, you can feel or experience when you're mourning with your community member is sometimes whoever is mourning, they will wallow, cry, deep despair. And
yeah.
and it's the only sound you hear.
Wow. Yeah.
And we're just there, you know, and yeah. we're, and it's, it's safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's safe to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we definitely come together when there's loss, whether it's tragic or expected, like a sickness. But it's sad that they don't do that as much as they used to.
And it could be because there's just so much more death now.
Yeah, like suicides and alcohol-related deaths, whether they're accidents or, yeah, which is very, very sad.
It's so sad. It's so sad that we've been almost forced to desensitize to how tragic these events are, because we've experienced them so many times. So yeah, it's it's different. But again, that was our generation. That's the way it still is, but not as.
Yeah, and it's all to do with generational trauma and not knowing what to do with the trauma and not knowing our authentic self and our authentic power and
coping mechanisms.
Yeah, learning healthy coping mechanisms. Yeah, because a lot of our parents went to either residential school or federal day schools, and they lost a lot of their identity and were shamed for being who they are. So it's we're still feeling the ripple effects. But I myself really like to talk about discovering, like, healing and reclaiming identity and standing for my beliefs and thriving to find
your life purpose. Skills tool belt.
Yeah. Yeah, like learning about life and healing and developing
more life skills, tools.
Yeah.
In your belt.
Yeah. And that's so important. And it's so great to see, like, other Inuit, like Tanya was my real inspiration to quit drinking. She quit 15 years ago. I quit 11 and a half years ago. And since then, I've really focused on learning about myself and really dismantling and unlearning the way I do things, the way I process things, the way I view things,
the way you learned how to do things while you were in trauma.
Yeah, my trauma responses and relearn. I mean, yeah, really relearning, rewiring on how I react and trying to recognize what triggers are and finding the root issues of how I react. And part of that is really linked to physical, like the body, listening to the body, because the mind, the body, and the soul are
one.
And if one's not working properly, the rest is affected. If one's sick, everybody, like it's all sick. So I really try and learn about those things and just listening. If my body is sick, why is it sick?
In Buddhist teachings, there's a teaching around what's called a samskara, or a habit pattern in a way. And in a way, throughout our lives, we move through because of our conditioning and our experiences. And absolutely that would include the experiences of our parents, because in a way, habits are passed down.
Very much.
And they're passed down consciously and unconsciously. And a samskara is like a groove. So you'd think of it as, actually, my kids had a book from the Berenstain Bears. I actually really liked the way that it was describing the groove that a wheelbarrow, you know, if you're pushing a wheelbarrow and there's a groove in the in the ground, you're going to just whoop, fall into the groove and start pushing it through that groove.
Yeah.
And when we're practicing quiet meditation, breath work, walking in nature, walking slowly, doing things slowly, we have an opportunity to examine what our habits are. And an example would be, am I hungry or thirsty? Am I looking for another coffee, or do I want to close my eyes for 10 minutes and have a nap? And these are things that, if we are able to practice in ways that are truthful to ourselves and reflective of who we want to be.
Give ourselves the time of day.
Yeah, give ourselves the time of day and our capital S selves, the selves that we want to be, the selves that call to our history and our ancestors' history, that we are able to listen in a different way so that we start to create our own grooves.
Yes. And yeah, I had this really great therapist that had this imagery of our of the like the paths that we're used to, toxic paths. Like, for example, if you're in a forest, there's this trail that you're used to using, and it's like you, it's a clear trail in a forest, so there's no branches in your way. Although it's unhealthy, it's safe to you because you've used it your whole life. And that's how we can be with like toxic relationships.
And addiction.
Mm-hmm. Addiction. Yeah, it's a path that you've always used. You know it. Even if it's toxic, it's your path. So when we realize that, okay, this is not healthy, I must create a new path. So my brain has to create a new habit, a new path consciously. And it's painful. It's disorienting. You're unsure because you're used to this path, but now you must create a new one. But there is no path. There is no, it's not clear.
And you're going to get a branch in your face, yeah, and you're going to fall down. You're, yeah, covered in mud, and
it's more, yeah, work.
It's more work. It's harder.
It's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And automatically you want to go to your old path because you know you've gone through it, mm-hmm, thousands of times. But you must tell yourself, no, that's a toxic trait. I'm going to go this new path, and eventually this new path is gonna become clear and healthy, and then eventually this old path will disappear with the new growth. And I found that very helpful.
I like that
visually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Getting back to being northerned, well, there's one thing you mentioned and then just moved on, but talking about having water shortages sometimes, mm-hmm, this, I was thinking about it because this week we had a plumber at my house, and you know, we have like a thing that we put our water into, that a Berkey filter, you know, to uh-huh, purify it. Mm-hmm. So we had all the water shut off in the house this whole day while the plumber was there. And I was really conscious of, okay, how much water am I using? Do I have enough? Like, I'll just take a tiny bit.
Imagine
to wash
being
my hands.
Like that your whole life.
Well, see, that's mm-hmm, what I, when you mentioned, yeah, that casually, I just thought to myself, wow, like I've only ever experienced that, mm-hmm, when, in very specific situations, mm-hmm, for pretty short periods of time. And so I just wanted to, I don't know if you feel like talking about that a little bit, but sure, it just made me really curious what, mm-hmm, what that was like, what that
so,
is like. I mean,
yeah, there's, as I said, we're 14 communities in Nunavik, and the one in 14 communities, Kutjuarapik, mm-hmm, partly has underground water service because they're more south, mm-hmm, so they don't have permafrost like we do in, let's say, Khoaktak. So once a day, there's a water delivery truck.
By the municipality.
Yeah, okay. the town. Yeah, the municipal services come deliver water or suction bad water with the sewage truck.
So we have two tanks attached to every house.
Yeah.
One water, one sewage. And then we have water trucks and sewage trucks that come.
On a daily basis. But then again, like each community has different personalities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Different management. Mm-hmm. Some are more organized, mm, than others. Like for my community, we're lucky enough that we receive service 7 days a week. It used to be only 5 days a week.
So that means no laundry, no showers, sometimes no dishes on the weekend.
Wow.
And imagine
bigger
having
families.
Yeah,
wow.
Imagine having a newborn baby and it's a blizzard.
And yeah, we're told, mm-hmm, if there's a blizzard,
conserve your water.
Yeah.
Wow.
because it runs out. It runs out like every Christmas, where many people at my parents' house, and it always runs out. Like every day, it runs out for a few hours, and then we have to like track down the water truck driver or go on Facebook Huaktamuk page, or
we call it the golden truck.
Oh my god,
they're yellow too.
Yeah, yeah, the sewage truck is all yellow, so it's called the golden truck.
And you just learn to be like that, you know. You learn to be conservative.
Yeah.
So like when you move down south, you're used to taking really quick showers, and not running the faucets when you're washing the dishes.
Yeah,
like we have somebody from back home that comes to clean our house 5 days a week, and it irks me that the water dribbles so lightly when they're doing the dishes, but I understand where that comes from. You know, I totally understand. It's just built in us now to be conservative with our water.
I mean, we all should be.
Yeah.
But you just, even sometimes, you know, when I'm thinking to myself, oh, this is kind of a long shower, I can still take a long shower. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
even
you have the choice.
I have the choice. Uh-huh. And it's really.
And then you get conflict as well, because a lot of our homes, they're duplexes, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, there's this big, huge blame game for.
You can hear your neighbor.
Yeah, yeah. They used all the water because you share a water tank or a sewage tank.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So it's like, fucking Emily.
Hitting the wall.
Fucking doing laundry on the weekend. You know? So it's, I mean. It's a whole nother world where we come from. It's very, very, very different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you yell at the person who takes the long showers, mm-hmm. like my son, for example. We're not in Montreal. Right,
and that's just one example of how life is different for us up there. You know, we have all these strange ways of living. Up there too. I'm trying to think of another one. Like, you know, here you'll take an Uber to the concert or to the store, or you know, your elderly mother will take the city bus to her hospital appointment. But then there's like my grandma on her snowmobile, driving herself to the hospital for her appointment, and you know, so we see it's just life is real. Or you see a 15-year-old with their little sister behind them being sent to go check the mail at the post office, and they're on a quad, you know. Mm-hmm. Life is so different.
We become responsible at a very young age, because we have like huge families, and it's just normal for everybody to take care of the kids.
Huge families and housing shortage.
Yeah. There lots of crowded houses, which lead to more sicknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Which and always ties to systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything is like systemic racism. Colonialism.
I can't even say it, so that's why I keep saying white people.
Colonization
shortcut.
WP. Peoples. There's such a huge crisis that is the root of so many problems in the north, is the housing shortage. You have people living with their grandchildren, with their children who are a new couple, you know, trying to figure out life together and learn how to have healthy conflict, but they're living with their parents and their newborn children, small toddlers, all in one house that runs out of water, that overflows with the sewage, and that food costs too much. And it's The housing crisis up there is definitely the root of, or if it was solved almost 99 problems would be gone. Mm. You know,
do you have any opinions about things that could make it better? I mean, we the obvious money. One is just money. That's we what need I was going to say.
Yeah, but, funding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. We get almost all houses are social housing, mm-hmm. and then there's the Katowic School Board, which is the only school board in Nunavik, has housing for their employees who come from the south. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Katowic Regional Government, who I think it's only in Gudjok. It's only in Gudjok that they can have housing if they work for that organization. So yeah, it's mainly social housing, and then there's the home ownership program, which a handful of people in the communities can afford. So
and the social housing wait list is like
it's insane.
Probably minimum 10 years.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is now, but I mean, I know like when I applied for my own house, I must have been 17 or 18, and my minimum wait was 10 years.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
So what were my options, you know? So these are the options. You find a job that maybe has housing, you know, so then, you know, you're limited to where you want to work. Mm-hmm. Or you get in a relationship with somebody who has housing. Which was kind of the case for me because I was living with my grandmother. I was kind of bumped around all my life, and it's a big reason why I moved to Montreal was because I had nowhere to live. And if I wanted to live there, I had to be in a relationship that I didn't want to be in. Mm-hmm. Or yeah, be homeless.
It's these issues.
Or that live are with very my elderly real. Grandmother. Screams at me.
Yeah. So it's like, it's no, a reality doesn't. For a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy that like we've had these conversations with friends and family who live in the north, like Tanya and I live in Montreal, but we're still very connected to Nunavik. And it's crazy how toxic, violent, single men will be basically rewarded mm-hmm. a home.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right.
What is that about?
Like, imagine an overcrowded house, like a house with 11 people, a 4-bedroom house,
one
or
bathroom.
A 3-bedroom house with 11 people of all ages. And it's chaotic. And someone who lives there is violent. So to make everyone, I guess, less stressed.
Safer.
Mm-hmm. They'll put that person, that violent person, priority on the house waiting list while there's like single...
It's like giving
independent
gold.
Yeah. Working giving gold people will be less prioritized because there's like angry
and again like you
who are not working.
There's a point system for the wait list, and if you have children you automatically get more points. So in order it's for like, me to have a home, I have to have children, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's so frustrating.
Is there ever a situation where people leave, try to find a home, find a place, and then wait to come back? Or is there once you go, you don't go back?
You must be living in your community for a year. Mm-hmm. In order to be considered back on the list.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And so
it's
like you have to suffer.
Right.
Come back and suffer uh-huh. if you want to be on this list.
And if you want to live more. In your home. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then so those violent men who get their housing, does that then create situations of a lot of domestic abuse? Because mm-hmm. there are women who are looking for housing and they're like, well, this guy isn't that great, but at least I can have a place.
Yeah. And it builds the tolerance of the amount mm-hmm. of abuse mm-hmm. that they are willing
right.
to go through. Because what are their options? Mm-hmm. That or be homeless.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In the mm-hmm. in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very tough, tough situation. Yeah.
It's hard to and it's like a drop in the bucket of our problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it's interesting what you said though, that so many problems would be solved if just that one was addressed.
Yeah. It was who was talking about the bike paths yesterday? Adam.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bike paths, how much problems would be solved in the city, in the big urban cities, if there was more bike paths, because this would happen, this would happen, this would happen. And that's the same thing for us and housing. If mm-hmm. if we were given housing, you know, young adults would learn to live on their own, learn to be a family, learn to work through conflict without extreme anxiety, without extreme anger, without extra anger, without, you know.
Because it's like housing shortage has been linked to suicide as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you, I mean, I know what it feels like. I'm still running from feeling homeless. It's something that that drives me every day. I live in this 10 steps forward all the time. And it's directly because I've always felt homeless, or I've always felt unstable, or that it could be ripped away from me at any second. So, you know, imagine that, and then not having the option to run away to the south, or to being too scared to even try that. And why should we have to run away to the south, you know? So absolutely, I can see where it's linked to suicide, and that hopeless feeling that this is it, you know, this is my life. It's never going to get better than this.
Yeah, and everything we're talking about in terms of silence mm-hmm. and getting that space to hear, mm-hmm. like you're saying, to mm-hmm. to hear your inner voice and to know who mm-hmm. you are and to know what you want to be in the world and how you want to express yourself mm-hmm. is all in conflict mm-hmm. with having everyone else's opinion. I mean, mm-hmm. the recipe, it's a recipe for conflict, mm-hmm. having all of those voices around you, mm-hmm. especially when you throw domestic violence into mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And poverty and...
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing too is like, it's not a huge population. You know what I mean? In terms of if there was a will to make this situation
better. And
in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, at least like just talking about.
From a land that our government reaps from so much.
Profits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just even if you got a tiny part of the profits from. The you know all of the energy resources that have been taken from mm-hmm. that land and or any of it, you know, even without putting it in this very capitalist perspective of oh, Canada got money from this, so you know they should give this money back. If there was a will there, mm-hmm. the population is not so huge that they couldn't build that housing. It's not unimaginable.
And it's the same thing as
how
like,
many houses you know to build,
and every single one would help, whether it was five or 500. Any number would help.
Yeah.
Yeah, and financially, it's not a huge ask.
Especially the type of houses that were our social housings are. You know, they're matchbox houses.
They're so cheap.
Dirt cheap to make down here.
Mm-hmm. Like, they're so cheap, and, like, they choose the cheapest available materials, mm-hmm. and they don't even try and make the cabinets nice, the flooring, like nothing. They it's
And they're molding.
They mold easily.
And because of the permafrost and the fast way that they're building them, you know, the ground is shifting under them. The houses are cracking in half. It's just, it's a mess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, if you can, as an Inuk, an indigenous person, you can't help but to say sometimes, like, if they, why are they putting all this money to other countries to help when they can't even help us in the same country?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some indigenous fly-in communities in Canada with no drinking water for 25 years, boil water advisory. Imagine.
Mm-hmm. It's a basic human right.
It's a human right. Basic bit. And then they go like on rescue missions to other countries. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
And in terms of learning, we could just learn so much outside of being respectful and honoring that we are all living on unceded land, that we could also support a population that could potentially be our wisdom teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a wisdom teacher teaching from this land, from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so vastly under-resourced when that really doesn't need to be the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of why it's so good that you're doing this podcast, Beatrice, and just that you're sharing these things. Because even, you know, the first episode that you invited me to be on, I was trying to look up information about the Arctic Winter Games, and it was pretty hard to find good information. And even some of the information that I found, it like combined, it just kind of threw everything together from other winter games and
the umbrella.
Mm-hmm. It did the umbrella thing. And, you know, and then, you know, for every, even just for today, saying what the topics were going to be, you know, I was trying to look things up, and it's a little tricky to find just basic information. And, you know, I've been in Canada 20 years now, and you only hear about things on the news if there's a big specific crisis, but outside of the big specific crises, I don't think it's in people's consciousness is just what the daily situation is, what the real lived situation is.
Mm-hmm. It makes producing the podcast really, really tough.
I bet.
You're like northerned all the time. 24/7 northern.
So I've learned so much. It's just, you know, thank you so much for inviting me on this. But I'm looking forward to other people learning, hearing too, and listening and learning. And, you know, it's really important. And it could in many ways, with not that much more resources and not that much more consciousness about what's happening, things could be so much better.
Mm-hmm.
It's
the first thing in learning is hearing and then doing something about it. We have to be vocal, right? Or else nothing is gonna change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Canada as a whole needs to heal, but you need to heal the root of Canada, and that's us.
Yeah.
You know, so invest in your roots and,
I mean, Canada still, the government of Canada is only starting to admit the wrongs that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
But they still don't want to admit fully.
Mm-hmm.
They're reluctant.
They're still reluctant, and they're still kind of minimizing their part in committing atrocities to Inuit and Indigenous people alongside the Catholic Church. So there's still a lot of work to do.
but look at our youth now, like our guests we had today. Look how loud and strong our youth are. You know, it won't be much longer before the whole world knows. And it's okay. You know, look how resilient they are. Look how resilient we are. Look what we've survived, and look what we have to show for it. And the silence is being broken.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think there's like tell me if this is too left field, but I've just been thinking about it a lot lately, because partly because of climate change, but then, you know, there were these balloons flying from China everyone was talking about in the news. But with climate change and things are melting, you know, the Northwest Passage is melting, things like that. And all of a sudden, many people in this, more of the South, are recognizing, wait a second, there's this like Northern Territory in Canada, and there are people there, and realizing that, oh, it has this like significance for them all of a sudden, like politically and geopolitically and these things. What that means in the future, like, you know, 10 years from now, that will be even more the case as more of the ice melts and, you know, other countries are trying to claim passage through these areas. Just that big thing, you know, superimposing itself onto the lived reality. On one hand, I see it as, oh, maybe an opportunity. People will start paying more attention and realizing. And then on the other hand, you know, is that going to be just even more pressure for people, you know, the South, to want to take more control? Or I don't know if you have any feelings about that.
It's a very touchy topic because, well, let me just first mention the relocation story, part of Canada's dark secret, where Canada, the government of Canada, took a dozen families from Inukjuaq, Nunavik, and they lied to them. They told them, we're going to move you to the high Arctic, where there's plenty of animals. You're going to have jobs. And jobs were very new to Inuit in the 1950s is when the settlements became communities, villages with a nursing station and a school. And that's how the government wanted to assimilate Inuit into their culture so they can be smart and educated like the white people. So if you want to earn money, if you want to earn welfare, you have to stop going hunting. You have to stay sedentary like us and
learn. Send your kids to school.
Send your kids to school if you want welfare. So what's the solution? Let's kill 75,000 dogs across Canada.
That's the thing I heard. Because didn't they kill the dogs so that they couldn't run, leave in their sleds?
They couldn't go hunting.
Yeah. They couldn't provide for their families. Mm-hmm.
So imagine all the Inuit men having their livelihood, their manhood, their ability to provide for their families, for their children, for their village, taken away in front of them, violently burnt, sunken into the ocean in a pile. And their elderly family. Men still cry to this day when
their family. They're dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like they're everything. So
Mike.
Yeah. Tissue time again.
Tissue time.
So that's one.
Oh, I get to go.
One government appointed action that was taken to assimilate Inuit. So RCMP men were sent to each community, and people still remember this because this was very recent. this was from the 50s to the 60s.
Wasn't it even later, some of it I heard? Maybe the whole program. I don't know. I saw, do you know Lakuluk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a great friend of mine.
Theater piece called, did you see it, Kinnelik, These Sharp Tools?
Yeah,
because Evelyn Perry is my sister-in-law. So that's how I,
okay.
the woman she did the show with.
Okay, I made the poster.
Okay, oh, great job. I loved it.
I mean, the translation, I mean.
But I mean, I just, my jaw was dropped. I was crying. It's a theater piece that tells, part, it tells many things, but part of it, it tells this story that people don't know about outside of the North.
Know about. And it's deliberately not taught.
And it wasn't that long ago. And I feel like it was in that piece where I think Lakuluk was mentioning that maybe at least some parts of it weren't dismantled until the 90s even or something. It's not long ago. I mean, 1950s, 60s.
Yeah. That's
not even a generation ago.
No. So that's one of the things. And then back to the relocation story. So the government told these Inuit, these naive, obedient Inuit who don't talk back, who don't question the white man, that just do whatever the white man says, packed a very few little belongings. They brought the clothes that they wore, and it was in August. And they're told, you don't need to bring anything else because everything will be provided. You're going to have warm houses, you're going to have jobs, and your children will love it because there's an abundance of games and toys, and it's going to be great. And it was a month-long journey, and they went to the high Arctic like with nothing, with tents. And then it's the high Arctic, so it was like in September, it was already snowing, and it was the sun was getting like lower and lower because the high Arctic has 24-hour sunlight in the summer, in the short summer, and then 24-hour darkness for 6 months of the year. And there was nothing. And there's documentaries online that you can watch of the survivors. So from men providing from abundance of fish, seal, caribou, goose, like everything to Mars, basically. Mm-hmm. There's not enough... When it came winter, they were in their tents with no bedding.
Oh my God.
No warm clothing because the government told them, you're going to have everything. We can't bring a lot of stuff. We're in a ship and we're a dozen families. These women had their children and then 24-hour darkness came, and they haven't learned the land. They haven't had time to observe and learn the land, and they didn't even find animals anywhere. So they were starving. Babies were dying, and mothers were not producing milk because they didn't have anything to eat.
Malnourished. Mm-hmm.
And this particular story always stays with me. Because I transcribed and translated the documentaries. Mm. And this woman, this elderly woman, was talking about her memories. And she said they needed water, drinking water. So they didn't have flashlights or torches, nothing. So she went outside on her hands and knees with an axe and a bucket. Oh. And she couldn't see anything, so she was feeling for ice. And she said, okay, this feels like ice. So she took her axe and she hit the rock, and it sparked. Like the hopelessness that she felt. To that point, because the government needed human tadpoles so that they can say, Canadians live here.
This is the north. It's
the most northern point, the most Arctic community.
So they use for sovereignty. Inuit bodies. Ugh. Like it's like the worst game of Survivor. Mm-hmm. It's the most sick thing.
Hunger Games.
And no one.
Hunger Games. Yeah.
No one heard of them for a year.
Their families they left behind.
No one heard about them. They were not contacted. They didn't contact anyone. And you know what? They had an RCMP post a few miles away and ordered them, do not feed the Inuit. Make sure they don't go through your garbage for food. Oh.
And guess what? They survived. They're still there.
Yeah. Wow. They made it their home.
But the fact that they could do that, like really, and especially when I think of like the Western people who are like trying to go to the Northwest Passage and these like they all died. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They brought their teacups and like, you know, just ridiculous. They had no idea. And the fact that these people, survived is, it's like, it speaks so much to the genius and the spirit and so many things.
And they've born new generations and it's a thriving community. And what's so kind of underlined, hidden, special about that community is that although they're in highest Arctic Nunavut, and they came from Nunavik, our territory, our region, and so they've been living there for over 60 years, they still have our dialect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They speak like us.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Have you been up there?
No, not
it's
yet.
Too far.
It's far, right? I've been to Pondinlit, which is not far. Mm. So how the people, the new people, it's called Resolute Bay. Grease Fjord, there are two communities that are close together. How they survived is people from Pondinlit, Inuit from Pondinlit, who were already living there, were sent by the government to teach Inuit about the land and what animals, because it was basically like it's a different world, different animals, different
Mars. It was.
So that's how they survived. Other Inuit teaching them about, here you can see on the map. So that's Pondinlit. Mm. They had Inuit there, even in those days, and then find Resolute Bay.
Got a pretty good producer over there.
Oh, yeah. Jeremy's great. We'll keep him. Maybe we need to find someone else to find Kleenexes, though.
Yeah.
You guys need to sponsor. This podcast needs to sponsor its own brand of Kleenex.
Because I think every episode.
Okay. Tanya?
I have a trick. I have a mom trick for this. So when you grow out of like really soft pajamas or your kids grow out of them, you take the pajamas and you cut them into little hankies. and then you don't have any hard like on your nose.
You got any pajamas, Mike?
I have a hanky in my pocket. I'll bring you some.
All right.
I'm always freaking crying, man.
Well, the name Resolute is amazing because you had to. Wow, that is an unbelievable story, and when I hear it, my desire is to hear it again and again. Mm-hmm. And I hope that this podcast and all of the incredible work you're doing is able to bring these stories again and again. Mm-hmm. And I'm your first fan.
Yay. Oh.
No, even though it has a
second.
I can't wait to hear all the stories because I think that the government support is so directly linked to people understanding, Canadians understanding how important this heritage is.
Very much.
And how this genius, resolute, hero, unbelievable strength, wisdom, knowledge. It's extant. It exists. Mm-hmm. And we have no access because there's no support and mm-hmm. for generations. And it can't just be.
No.
It cannot be like that anymore. And I think that what you're doing is really going to bring that voice out into the world so that we can hear these stories more and more.
Yes.
Beatrice, could you put links to the documentaries that you were talking about?
Yes, in the notes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see those.
Oh, yes.
Me too.
We'll provide that. Yes. So let's...
We have a question from a couple of littles.
Yes.
If you'd like.
Yes.
Lydia and Alicia Oyokoluk.
Jesus, dear. Hi, bitches, dear. Kun Alicia kun uyo kulo yung tusang ni kaya ka imuta seven ngo yung imuta aya tangan ni aya ay bangu kaki bangu ay bay lang yung bay lang yung bay imu Emu talo talo manlo ki kechan ki kiona ki kiona ay nakatukot tayo imu teko parumal sa parumal sa imu tao 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 takamuna ipetikalay lai na po alakalay na po imu
Good job, girl.
That's so adorable. Kids make the world go around. Kids definitely make the world a better place.
They didn't actually have a question. They were just debuting. Yeah.
They stole the platform. So cute. They said they liked Imuta and they sang it for us. Mm-hmm. Lovely. Let's play another song. So, Tanya's Tanya's
big day.
Joey.
Yeah.
Yuwini. Mm-hmm. His stage name and actually his second name, is it? Or his
it was
name?
Like the nickname he was given when he was a little boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's your fiancé.
Mm-hmm. Some days.
From Kucha.
Not last night. Snoring so loud.
Yeah. Joey is an amazing singer-songwriter who is just coming out with his album soon. And today he released his first single called Ananama. And Joey asked me to throat sing on this album, on some of the songs on the album, and I gladly accepted. And I am so happy and proud to play the single on our mm-hmm. podcast. So let's listen to it. It's called Ananama, My Mother. Oh
beautiful. If I can translate that for you, he's saying, in the words of my Ananaka, like my cute mother, his mom was small. Yeah.
His mother was actually his grandmother. His grandmother adopted him, so that was his mother. Mm-hmm. She was this cute little old lady that always had a scarf on. That's the picture of the single is it's a scarf that she always wore.
So yeah, Joe is singing when it gets very hard and heavy, reach out. You're never alone. You're never alone. Don't think you're alone. Reach out. Talk to someone. Those are the words of my mother. We may feel the need to cry when it gets hard. And it's okay. Like, cry it out. Those are the words of my mother. Joe is, I love Joey. He's such a, now that's a, resilience. Resilience. I am so proud of Joey.
You know, sometimes we talk about when we slow down enough to get married because we're not married. That if we were to get married, that we would just cry the whole time because we work so damn hard. You know, we never stop. We're just always, 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 we work together. We work separately. And then we have like these little accomplishments like this to show for it. And
he works so hard. Like he works so with hard. The homeless. Wow. He has a real heart for the homeless.
The homeless Inuit
in Montreal.
Homeless cats.
And homeless cats.
And again, it's this, it's kind of full circle about what we were talking about, you know, and having to feel 10 steps ahead of this forever fear of being homeless. And I think it's something that drives both of us. And I said the other day, I mean, Joey and I are a team, the real definition of a team. You know, I'm nothing without him. And what are they going to say? That we have this duty to leave our world a better place. And I like to say that Joey's done it, you know. He's done his duty.
Yeah. He does it every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he writes beautiful music. Yurini is his artist name, and he has an EP out from a couple of years back, and beautiful songs.
Surprise, nobody knew, not even me. And then he's like, hey, I'm an incredible singer, songwriter. Ta-da!
Surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's super talented too. He was we can talk about Joey all the time. It would be better to have him here on this podcast. He'll be here.
I'll take a day off and Joey can come.
Yeah.
Because together.
Will Joey be as good at making everyone cry, though, as you are?
Sounds like it.
He's the most articulate. Inuktitut is his first language, and he speaks beautifully. In our language, he's moving, he's healing, he's experienced, he's truthful.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that we have a man in that place with those talents at this day and age. We're really lucky to have my Joey.
Mm-hmm. And sober like you.
Sober like, he's like 1 year older sober than me.
Yeah.
Joey and I were actually really good friends when we were teenagers, like really, really good friends. And then he wrote a song about it. It's so sweet.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah.
Please put a link to Joey's music.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We will. We will. Thank you, ladies, so much for being here with us today. And guys, thank you so much for being the technical brains and making us look nice. And
giving us Kleenex.
Yeah.
And
toilet paper. And food. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Let's do this again.
Yes, thank you.